From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made early last month on the campus of Middlebury College in Vermont. On March 2nd, one of the college's clubs, a group with conservative leanings, hosted author Charles Murray as a guest speaker. Murray is a conservative political science known, among other things, for examining links between social inequality and intelligence and race and genes. A Middlebury student introduced Murray to a crowd of nearly 400 protesters, saying he was invited so students could hear different points of view and even challenge his points. But when Murray walked on stage, the crowd of nearly 400 began chanting phrases like, "Who is the enemy? White supremacy," and "Racist, sexist, anti-gay, Charles Murray, go away." After nearly 20 minutes, the event was shut down and Murray was escorted off stage. He and a professor carried on with the talk in a private location where the professor did challenge his research. And that professor was later attacked by a protester and taken to the hospital for whiplash. This is just one of the most recent incidents on campuses where the issue of free speech is at stake. And there's a lot to discuss, the peg of which is the fact that RIT is hosting a symposium this week, The University as a Marketplace of Ideas, the debate over free speech and fundamental fairness on campus. And they have a lot going on, including a lecture tonight from one of our guests. So let me go ahead and welcome our guests for the hour. Glad to have Alan Charles Kors here. He is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and co-founder of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. An honor to have you. Thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you.
Also here is Joseph Fornieri, who is professor of political science and the director of RIT Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Richard Feldman is here. He's a professor of philosophy and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Engineering at the University of Rochester. Rich, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And David Primo is an associate professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester. David, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Joseph, you got a big event coming up tonight here, so why don't you at least set the stage for what RIT is doing and why this week?
Obviously, as you had mentioned, this has been in the news, and I think it is a cause of concern, in particular since May 2011, there has been a directive from the Office of Civil Rights from the Department of Education, which has expanded some of the Title IX measures that, in my judgment, have infringed upon speech. So I wanted to begin a conversation about this. Speech occupies a privileged place in our constitutional scheme. And, of course, the academy is really to be the citadel of speech and the place where a free exchange of ideas could occur. So I think it's somewhat ironic that we're seeing speech chilled in the very environment in which there should be a robust exchange of ideas. So I wanted to lead a conversation on this topic.
Tonight, 7 p.m. in Ingle Auditorium. You're going to hear Alan Charles Kors give a lecture, No Freedom of Speech, No Higher Education, as part of this symposium. It's free and open to the public, Joe?
That's yes. Right? Yes.
All right, so free and open to the public tonight. And Alan is somebody very well known among for those of us sort of following these kind of debates and discussions for a number of years. So if I can just start with a general question, and then we'll kind of, I'd like to work through what happened in Middlebury, for example, and work through some of these recent events. But Alan, let me just start with a general question. The framework that a lot of people are operating on recently is that college campuses lean pretty left, student bodies lean pretty left, and that generally students and some professors who lean left are intolerant of ideas from the right. Do you agree with that general framework?
I think that is correct as a general framework, but we're power held by the right on campuses. I think you would see the same dynamic of double standards and of repression of speech. Power changes hands, which is why we seek to limit it, so that at all times, all people have an equal protection of the law in terms of their freedom of speech. But you're quite correct about the current dynamic.
Okay.
And it's doubly ironic because the left that gave us the free speech movement has now given us speech codes. And there's something of a generational swindle in that.
Well, I want to listen to some of the audio from the Middlebury protesters. In this audio, I mentioned some of the chants that you heard. You're going to hear some of that, but there's also something in particular I want to focus on. So first, let's listen to what some of the Middlebury students were chanting when Charles Murray came for his event. Okay, so what I want to pick out in particular is the chant, "Your message is hatred, we cannot tolerate it." They are saying we are intolerant of certain things, including hatred, and in their view, probably intolerant. So, Alan, let me start with you, and we'll get our entire panel's feelings on this. I think there are, my guess is if we had protesters from that night sitting here right now, they would say, we are all for tolerance, love, openness, understanding. But we should not be forced to tolerate intolerance. We should not be forced to tolerate obvious hatred or racism, sexism, any of the isms. And that is where intolerance is okay. We don't have to listen to that. They're saying it right there. Your message is hatred. We cannot tolerate it. What would you say to them?
They're not saying we don't have to hear it. Were they being coerced into attending a Charles Murray lecture? That would be we don't have to hear it. A perfectly legitimate reply. What they are really saying is no one can hear it. Those who want to hear it can't hear it. Those who disagree vehemently with Murray and would like to hear the arguments so as to better frame their own replies can't hear it. And to hear students chanting like that on a college campus is itself terrifying. And the interruption of speech on a college campus is terrifying. When I was fighting speech codes at my own university in the 1980s, early 90s, along comes the university honoring Andres Serrano, the sculptor, and his work of art, The Piss Christ, which was a crucifix immersed in the artist's own urine. And Catholic and evangelical students came to me, and they said, this is a terrible double standard. Let's get them to apply their own speech code to this. And I said, don't do that. Let anyone who wants to hear Serrano hear Serrano. Hold your own event. That's what the cross means to Penn. Here's what the cross means to us. It was the largest gathering of religious students who found each other, who talked to each other. Freedom is a wonderful medium, and to take it away is to lose one of the great gifts that a university, a free university, can provide to civil society.
In other words, the antidote for speech you don't like is more speech. But Alan.
And protest.
And protest, which is a form of speech.
But not protest that prevents people from hearing what they have come to hear.
And just playing devil's advocate here, just because we don't have any of the protesters from Middlebury or other campuses sitting here, I think what they would say is, look, we understand the point you're making, but they view Charles Murray the way they view people who have not just said things they don't like, but helped create a society that hurts people, that holds people back, that creates inequality. And therefore, they're drawing a line saying no more, that we shouldn't listen to that anymore, because it isn't just about speech we don't like, it's about actually hurting people. What would you say to them?
John Stuart Mill in On Liberty drew a wonderful distinction between the right of someone to say grain merchants are thieves anywhere at any meeting and chanting grain merchants are thieves to a crowd carrying torches marching around a grain merchant's home. The Supreme Court, in effect, has recognized this a clear and present danger. And when there is a clear and present incitement to harm and violence, then indeed one can restrict, due to circumstance and place, speech. But that on a college campus, people are unwilling to hear ideas and refine their own objections to those ideas, which is one of the great benefits of hearing ideas. Plus, if we all had the right to ban what we found hateful and harmful, we would all be reduced to silence. Because everyone's, I believe in free speech, comma, but those buts would add up to a ban on virtually all speech.
All right, Professor Professor Fournieri, we heard Alan say that listening to that kind of protesting in Middlebury is actually kind of terrifying on a college campus. You agree with that characterization?
I do. I think it's problematic, and I want to kind of add to Alan's remarks that the Supreme Court has distinguished very clearly in its jurisprudence for the past 100 years between speech and action. Odious symbols like burning of the cross and burning of the flag, that kind of symbolic speech is protected if it stops short of direct incitement of imminent lawless action or of what the court has deemed in the case of Virginia versus Black known as a true threat. Why has the court done this? Because the court recognizes the preferred place of freedom in our constitutional scheme. So in order to uphold any restriction of speech, there must be a very high burden that there's some imminent lawless action, there's some immediate threat. And again, I find it ironic that, you know, there is, I think, a risk-averse culture on many campuses that fear lawsuits. But, you know, the Supreme Court itself has paved the way for very broad protections, and in some ways we're not following the Supreme Court's own jurisprudence in terms of its landmark decisions, or those need to be applied. So I understand the concern about safety and hate speech, but I think that on campus as well as in civil society as a whole, we should abide by the distinction between speech and action, and the court, I think, has settled that matter very clearly and unambiguously in its landmark decisions.
Dean Feldman, Richard Feldman from the University of Rochester is rather distinguished for his work in epistemology, how we form beliefs. And I'm very curious to know how you view the current climate, take Middlebury or speak more broadly, just in terms of the way students are concerned about some of these voices coming to campus. They're concerned about pushing back with a message, you know, trying to make sure their points are heard as well, sometimes drowning out other points. How do you view this?
So I'll just make two comments, and you're not going to find any major disagreements on the issues that raised so far. I completely agree with the idea that college campuses should be the home for free speech, investigation of ideas, that students should be willing to listen to views that they disagree with and argue back. I mean, the standard line about the best respond to speech you don't like with more speech. I completely agree. I'd say further, respond to arguments that you don't like with refutations of those arguments and good arguments on the other side. So we're in complete agreement on that. I think the two things I'd say that really aren't, I don't believe in disagreement, but just to add to the discussion, I think we should be very careful about how we generalize about the views of students and not hold the view that they're all alike. Professor Primo had an event last night on campus where a wide variety of positions were defended regarding President Trump, and it was a respectful, intelligent, rational discussion, just the kind of thing we want. I think it's incumbent upon us as faculty and campus leaders to model that kind of respectful disagreement. So I think we can model for students how to behave within these areas, how to deal with disagreement, and we should recognize that many of them do want to do just that. And I can identify things that happened to our campus in the past year that illustrate exactly that.
And as Professor Primo said before the program, and I think astutely pointed out, they don't get the same kind of headlines. And I take that point. Professor Primo, how do you view the current climate right now?
You know, I want to reiterate what Rich Feldman said, in that students are often portrayed, because of what gets covered in the media, as basically a bunch of crazy people going around protesting nonstop. And that happens. And when it happens, it should be called out. It's bad behavior, it's detrimental to speech, and it's concerning. But I think a great number of students are committed to exploring ideas, and it's incumbent on administrators, faculty, and other students to make sure that those students who want a true and real liberal arts education actually get it. But I just want to pivot a little bit to thinking about you know, the more pernicious way in which speech can be stifled on campuses. So you hear about the protests, but there are these other subtle ways in which speech is limited by administrators or by faculty through the use of, Alan Charles Kors mentioned, speech codes, or through just the use of statements about what is and what isn't sort of acceptable language or acceptable discourse on campus. And it's that subtle sort of stifling of speech where, as a faculty member, you could say something. You wouldn't necessarily be punished, but you wonder, how will you be received by your colleagues? Or how will students react? Or how will administrators react if you take a particular position? And that potentially is more dangerous than the occasional protest or the occasional violence on campus, because it is far more widespread in the academy. So if you go and you look at what administrators say about speech, or yesterday a major university association released a statement where they defended free speech, because who's against free speech, right? How can you be against free speech? But then they said, but on the other hand, you know, these protesters, you know, they were acting in the spirit of the Vietnam era, you know, and what they perceived to be dangerous to society. So it was okay that they stifle speech. And so we start to get these exceptions, and if the exceptions grow big enough, all of a sudden the free exchange of ideas on campuses disappears.
All right, so before I turn to Alan Charles Kors to expand on that point, why don't we hit that point directly? If an administrator says, well, you know, look at Vietnam. I mean, those protesters felt like they had to make a point. They stood up to do it. Some of today's students might be in that spirit. You think it's important to say, no, they're not?
I do, because there, I mean, so it's important to, you know, you get into trouble when you're trying to say, should we compare this to Vietnam? Sure. What should we compare it to? But the general point there is that first of all involved sort of the U.S. government coming onto campus, right? So that was that was the issue there in terms of trying to recruit students for the war. But the second piece of this is that once you start opening up exceptions, but they really believe in this. But this is, you know, they believe that speech is violence. That's the new thing now. This is the new hot trend. Is we can stop Charles Murray from speaking because his speech is violence against us, and we need to stop that. And what's really, really worrying to me is that once you start defining speech, just words, as violence per se, that is a very, very slippery slope. And we saw that a lot in the wake of President Trump's election, when presidents around the country, university presidents, basically made the point that if you were a Trump supporter, you probably shouldn't say too much on campus. You weren't the one that really was affected by this election, whereas the students who didn't support Trump, clearly, right, this was almost like violence against them, the fact that he won. And that's worrisome. That's worrisome to me.
Okay, Professor Kors?
I could not agree more with the last two points made. It is not a question of students as a generic category. The majority of students, my sense is, and I live closely with students, I spend a lot of time with students informally as well as formally. My sense is that students believe in free speech, look for a more open campus, but that certain groups have achieved an ability to instill fear of response, both many encouraged by administration, some bullying administrations, some encouraged by faculty, some affecting faculty, and certainly intimidating other students.
Certain groups like what?
Well, now it would be people involved in the militant sides of Black Lives Matter, militant sides of issues of sexuality and gender, militant sides of anti-Trump politics on campus. If someone went to a college president and said, you know, the Newman Center Catholics are really upset, that does not send a frisson of fear down an administrative spine. If you say you've really upset the campus feminists, that does. But you can't have a double standard in terms of speech and the freedom of expression. And to reinforce the last point made, what's so frightening is students have become afraid to talk honestly to each other. They've become afraid to share their actual opinions, their beliefs with each other because of the fear of how they'll be labeled. Whereas the great learning in the early 1970s, I co-founded a college house at Penn. And we recruited among the most diverse parts of the campus. We had living together, 180 students, Campus Crusade for Christ and the first wave of gay liberation. We had the Catholic Newman Center, vehemently pro-life, and we had first wave feminists vehemently pro-choice. We had the College Republicans, then as now virtually an underground group on campus, and Maoist revolutionaries. They offended each other all.
And they lived together.
Yes, they offended each other all the time. We ate four nights a week together as a house, and in the course of time, they learned to talk to each other. And they developed a certain empathy.
Because they were together a lot?
Because they talked. Because it wasn't now just a view, it was another human being who had parents, who had experiences, who was going through the same phase of life you were. They learned to humanize their relationships and far more than today's totalitarians could ever understand.
But you're describing eating together, living together. Are we more segmented on campuses now so we don't interact as much?
I think our campuses have become ever more balkanized and ever more segregated, and people don't talk to each other across lines across which they desperately need to talk to each other and come to know each other.
So Evan, if I could comment, as the college administrator in the room, I feel some obligation to say something in defense, and I don't really disagree with some of the points that have been made about things that university administrators might do that have the effect of shutting down speech. And I won't defend that, but I do want to say one other thing that we tried to deal with, that I was trying to deal with myself on our campus in the wake of the election last fall. There were students who were terrified. We had students, some international students, who came into advising offices. They clearly didn't understand the situation, but they were in tears. They said, "Do I have to leave?" So they didn't understand what the threats were, but nevertheless, the campaign that had happened where immigrants were demonized, and the threat they felt was real. And I thought it was incumbent upon us to try to say something supportive, to try to be comforting to them in the ways that we can, and try to set them, give them understanding of what the situation really was. So there's a line to be drawn there between the administration being avowedly political and taking a stance against candidates, and also trying to support our students, who I think in the wake of the tone of that election had some legitimate concerns.
Would you have felt the same had Mitt Romney won in 2012?
No, so that's a really interesting point. And I was at a meeting with peers from around the country not too long after the election, and all of us were talking about the statements that had gone out to the campuses, and somebody said, had the election gone the other way, would you have sent out a message telling the Trump supporters that the counseling services were available to them? And I think it's true to say that just about everybody in the room kind of looked down and was somewhat chagrined, because I think we knew the answer was probably not. Mm-hmm. And that was a good message.
But really, the reason I invoked Mitt Romney is I'm trying to decide to alight upon whether you think this is a unique situation in your experience.
In my experience, yes. I mean, this campaign, I think, was extreme and evoked a kind of fear among students that was unlike what I'm aware of in other occasions.
Professor Primo, I know you wanted to follow up on some of what you've heard. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Thinking back to the Trump campaign and the aftermath of the Trump campaign, what's interesting is that you know, very few, I think, members of the faculty at the University of Rochester, or perhaps many students, I think very few of them actually knew a Trump supporter. And that sort of speaks to what you were talking about earlier in terms of the segmentation and the polarization. And so this is really a moment for education that I think was missed. Because what I tried to do in my class was talk to students about the fact that, whether you like it or not, half of the country basically voted for this candidate. Half of the voters chose Trump. Why? How can we understand this phenomenon? And the easy explanation, oh, these are all a bunch of racists or xenophobes, just is too simple, right? And it's almost surely completely wrong, or at least mostly wrong, right? There's a far more complex set of reasons why Trump won. And that was really the educational opportunity that I think was missed in large measure, because for many of the faculty, I think they were more distraught about Trump's victory than most of the students. They were the ones who maybe needed the counseling, and so they projected that onto the students. So I had a student at my event last night come up to me and say, you know, I was doing fine after the election, and then I got this email from the university that kind of made me feel like I should, like, need counseling about this. And that's the sense in which I think we're setting students up for failure if we don't treat them like adults who need to get up the next day after something like this, pick up the pieces, and get to their jobs. As I said to students the next day, if you're a painter, if you're a welder, you don't get the luxury of sitting there and feeling sorry for yourself after something like this. You go to work. And that's what we needed to do as a university and as faculty that day. We needed to go to work. But instead, it was sort of this atmosphere of trauma on campus that I think, again, was a missed opportunity in my view.
All right, I know Professor Fournier and then Professor Kors want to jump in. Go ahead, Joe.
I'm all for supporting students, and I think that's our responsibility, and that we should provide a safe, we must provide a safe environment on campus. But I'm not for infantilizing students, and I think that there has been an infantilization has occurred, and I think much of it is driven by fear of lawsuits, and I think, Alan, you may want to speak to what is, in particular, legally generating that, some of the directives from the Department of Education, and how that has played out. And many of the universities are afraid that they will lose federal funding, and they're concerned about lawsuits. And that's unfortunate. To me, I see that as a kind of intimidation that's undermining free speech, faculty governance, and due process. Okay. I mean, the due process standard, for example, for sexual harassment on campus is the lowest evidentiary standard that we have. It's a, simply preponderance of evidence. It's a coin toss and a feather. That's remarkable. I mean, that could destroy someone's life, and these matters are being adjudicated by people who aren't lawyers or criminal lawyers. So it has to do with the compliance with federal laws.
Okay. Yeah. Al?
Yeah, just on that last point, my sense is that the Office of Civil Rights has basically given cover to what most universities wanted to do on their own. And now they have a legal cover to do it. But on this important point raised on the lack of diversity among faculty on campus, political, ideological diversity, this seems to me a very major concern. Not that there should be affirmative action for conservatives and libertarians on campuses in hiring, but there certainly should not be political litmus tests, implicit or explicit. There shouldn't be the bias confirmation that if someone has different political views, they must be dumb and unqualified to be on a faculty. Pauline Kael famously, after Reagan's second landslide victory, wrote in The New Yorker, how could he have won such a landslide victory? I don't know a single person who voted for him. The same would be true on most college campuses today. And the need, John Stuart Mill also once wrote that when no one is willing to argue a certain side of an issue that everyone else has decided is settled, you need people to play devil's advocate without announcing their role, to make the arguments in their strongest possible form.
We all need somebody in our circle who doesn't want groupthink.
No, exactly so. And his reasons were not only that those arguments might be true or might have a portion of the truth, but that if you don't hear them, then you're holding your own beliefs merely as dogma, untested, without the vividness of having to deal with people who disagree with you.
I'm way late for a break, and it's the only break of the hour. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to come back to get to your phone calls. Mary in Spencerport wants to push back a little bit. I got a very interesting email from a parent who says parents may be somewhat to blame for the culture on campus, so we'll get Kathy's email when we come back as well. If you want to call the program, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. You just heard Alan Charles Kors, who is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and co-founder of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He's giving a presentation tonight at the Ingle Auditorium at 7 p.m. RIT is hosting the symposium called The University as a Marketplace of Ideas, the Debate Over Free Speech and Fundamental Fairness on Campus. It's free and open to the public, 7 p.m. tonight in Ingle Auditorium. So Alan's here. You're hearing Professor David Primo from the University of Rochester, Professor Richard Feldman as well, and Joe Fornieri, who is the director of RIT Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty. Your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, is the failure of the AHCA a chance for Democrats to reach Trump supporters? Some progressive writers say yes, but many liberals are obsessed with Russia instead of focusing on the economy and exactly the areas that Trump supporters might be hurt by White House policies. We'll discuss the way forward with a diverse panel next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mary, Alice, Ethan, hang there on the phones. We're coming right to you. I'm going to start this segment with a listener's email. It's Kathy who writes, "My two cents is that parents are also to blame, myself definitely included. Our helicoptering caused us to shield our kids from anything disagreeable, rendering a generation that is unable to tolerate opinions different from their own, furthering the divide and the lack of understanding." Again, that's from Kathy. And then that's a big generalization, but her generalization is that kids are too insulated from ideas that they don't like right now. I say kids, young adults, to be fair. I shouldn't use the word kids. So Dean Feldman, what do you think?
I think there's some truth to that. Again, we should be very careful about generalizing.
But I
think there's some truth to that. And I'd like to add a more general point. And this comes out of my own work in philosophy, just a perspective on things. And it's how to think about arguments. Sometimes you think about an argument when you encounter a view that you initially disagree with as, so my job is now to refute that. There's a different perspective. It's, what can I learn from that? That is, what might be right about that? Maybe I ought to change my mind. And if you think about exchange with people with whom you initially disagree as opportunities to learn rather than combat in which your job is to try to beat them, I think we're all better off.
We always say, saying I changed my mind should be viewed as a sign of strength. It should be respected as opposed to a sign of weakness.
Isn't it depressing that in politics it turns out it's a weakness?
It's weakness. Yeah. No question about it.
It means you can't learn.
It should be a virtue, no question. Mary in Spencerport on the phone. Go ahead, Mary.
I would like to counter something one of you guys said about Trump getting support from half the country, and I don't think that's true. Trump had a very strategic victory, but only half of the eligible voters voted, and over half of them didn't vote for him. So I think there's possibly only 25% of the population that supports him. And I've been so tired of hearing people talking about his wonderful victory. It was strategic. It did not represent the majority of the people in the country.
But stay there, Mary. So I think that was Professor Primo making that point. I think it was roughly 60 million votes for Clinton, 60 million for Trump, 60 million who didn't vote. I mean, that's rough. So third, a third, a third. But what do you say to what you just heard? Professor?
I think the larger point still stands, which is let's say it's a quarter of adults that supported Trump. Still one in four people. And it's what I saw among the faculty at the U of R. It's what I saw among some sector of the students, but I actually think the students are a little more tolerant than the faculty in this regard. That sort of is what worried me, this idea that we're not going to try to understand why he has the support that he does. We're instead just going to say, ah, he's a racist, xenophobe, and therefore all of his supporters are. And I saw that. I mean, if you had seen my Facebook feed the day after the election from people who are professional political scientists and what they were writing, you would have been appalled. And these are the faculty members who go in front of students, and that is concerning. And I'm not, this is not a defense of Donald Trump, but it is to say that if we are analysts, if we are social scientists, we ought to act like that, even if personally we might be disturbed or upset by the outcome of an election.
All right, Mary, you want to follow up to them?
Yes. People do need to listen to one another, but the other side needs to listen too and admit that they are not representing the country when they are not listening to other people.
Mary, thank you for the phone call. I will say our next hour, we include a small business Trump supporter who's been on the program in the past, and I can't tell you how many emails I get from people saying, how dare you have that person on? They don't know what they're talking about. And listen, I mean, we have to make decisions every day with who we choose as guests for this program. We try to be representative, but we cannot simply decide that there are sectors of this electorate that don't deserve to have their voices heard. That's how we continue to go down this path of balkanization, to continue a term we heard. So to Mary's point, I agree. There's a little bit of an overabundance of, well, now the left has to understand Trump supporters. I get that, too. I get the eye rolling that happens on the left. But I do think everybody at least needs to try to listen, you know, unless maybe you think that hate speech is too far here. And some of our listeners feel like that real trauma is happening. Alice in Rochester on the phone wants to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Alice.
Hi, yes. I'm wondering if there is another kind of learning opportunity, especially involving militant students who don't seem to get the First Amendment thing, which I, you know, I think is extremely important. But I'm wondering how many of those students are traumatized by violence themselves, and B, has had their personalities formed in an atmosphere of violence, whether it is sexual or racial violence, that they're coming to terms with as trauma. And the fact that they're coming up with violent or at least militant ways of responding is something that maybe administrators and faculty could find better ways to respond to or feel more comfortable responding to if they take more consideration of trauma in college students, as we are in various other population segments, like trafficked people. There.
All right, Alice, thank you for the phone call. Let me start with Alan Charles Kors. Go ahead. What do you think, Alan?
The students at Middlebury are among the most privileged human beings on the face of the earth in the course of all of human history. The students at Berkeley are among the most privileged human beings in all of human history. People experience trauma. You could have a, quote, privileged white student whose father or mother committed suicide a month or two before the person entered college. That's trauma. That's trauma. You could have people who grow up in awful circumstances, though you'd be astonished at how few of those are on our flagship campuses. And to infantilize people, to use Joe's term, to say to anyone, we understand that you are what? Too weak to live with freedom? No one who tells anyone that they are too weak to live with equal protection of the law, too weak to live with the First Amendment and freedom of speech. No one who tells you that you are too weak to live with freedom is your friend. That is what we should be teaching students.
Dean Feldman, is that do you empathize at all or sympathize with what Alice is saying when you think about sexual assault victims, when you think about students of color who might have felt discrimination, you know, or do you agree with what Alan is saying here?
So I certainly agree with the caller that there are students on campus who have grown up in very challenging circumstances, have arrived on campus having experienced trauma.
Alan says not very many.
A decent number, though. How if at all, that connects to this, the attitudes towards speech and freedom of speech is another matter. And I don't know that there I could draw a really clear connection there. So I'd be careful about that. But I do think for some number of our students, I know a non-trivial number here at the U of R, There's truth like that, and there's factors that we should be attentive to. If I could very quickly just describe one anecdote, this is a little bit off our exact topic, but it might help help us understand something. Some years ago, I think it was around the time that it was the Charles Murray book, so 20, 25 years ago, I used an example in class out of the blue. It wasn't the topic of the class, but I used an example about race and IQ to illustrate a point about reasoning and something about statistics. And I hadn't talked, the two students weren't prepared for that topic. I just raised it. And after class, two black students came up to me they just said, I wish I had known that you were going to be talking about that, because discussing that topic in class, I felt exposed. I felt that you know, my intelligence was being questioned. And we don't object to your using the example, but we object to to the way it just sort of came up out of the blue and we were unprepared. And so they were talking about what's now called a trigger warning, but we didn't have the vocabulary then. And I thought they made a good point. I thought that was fair. That was a disturbing thing to them. And I think a thing we don't realize about some of our students is the number of things that affect them pretty deeply that to many of us just seem like no big deal, but to them really make a difference. And we do well to be aware of that.
So is there a middle ground where you say, look, it might not have been called a trigger warning then, but you thought it was a reasonable request, because they weren't saying you can't talk about that.
No, not at all.
There's a difference, though, by saying you can't teach that, you can't talk about it.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. It's just let us know so we're prepared. Yeah. Okay. I think that's fair.
I think that's an extremely important distinction. I'd go further that any movement toward trigger warnings will be the end of education. Trigger warnings about what? Your religious beliefs might get questioned. Your belief in an afterlife might get questioned.
But let's say you're a sexual assault survivor.
And
there's a film or a book. Should you get warned that the material may be difficult for you?
No, you've chosen to go to a university and you're going to be exposed. And the awful thing that happened to you is what happened. That's the trauma. That's the awful thing. Reading about rape is not the trauma of rape. However, it seems to me that apart from coercive trigger warnings imposed on faculty, there is what's just been explained, an understanding on the part of professors, a reasonableness, a sense of, I don't want to shock my students. I don't want to offend unnecessarily any student in this class. And I certainly don't want, it's not my goal, to make people feel personally uncomfortable. So common sense, decency, compassion.
But these not are trigger things, warnings.
But not trigger warnings.
Okay.
Or they'd be endless.
I've got to get through a few more phone calls here. A lot of people waiting to weigh in. Ethan, and I feel like the phone's about to ring more. Ethan, go ahead.
This is my first time calling in. Sorry if I'm bad at it. But I wanted to make a point. It sounds like the context of the people who are chanting about or causing these people who are coming in to talk at colleges to get them canceled. Like, it sounds like it's just people are, like, minority groups in particular are very upset. So I think to say, like, that we're terrified or frightened that free speech is under threat just kind of seems moot. You know, it seems like everyone's just really upset with the election, and there is some real, I mean, regardless of what the reasons were, whether or not it was manifest through Trump's rhetoric or it was through faculty members or whoever, people were genuinely hurt by the election, and it was minority groups in particular, I think, who were targeted. So I guess if I could say anything, I would wonder if your speakers could talk about that and maybe defend or see that perspective, I guess.
Okay.
About people who are just kind of really angry, and they, I think, are justified in the anger that they feel.
All right, Ethan, thank you. So let's think about, I think, Professor Primo, you raised the question on how students versus professors were feeling. He is saying, think about students of color, students from maybe immigration backgrounds, students in the LGBTQ community who might have felt threatened and legitimately hurt by the election. Do they have more standing to say that they were legitimately harmed?
All students, I argue, have the right to express their views. And certainly, you know, for students, for instance, whose visas were potentially caught up in the executive order issued by President Trump, of course, this affects them directly. I don't begrudge them having very strong views on the issue. Where it becomes concerning is when we sort of give a free pass to those students to then create disruptions to the rights of other students to have an educational experience.
Or to speak.
Yes. There was a protest on campus at the University of Rochester a few days after the Trump victory. And it was very impassioned. They had speakers making very strong denunciations of the president-elect at the time. But it was done in a very non-disruptive fashion. It was a protest where the students wanted to get their voices heard. They had faculty show up. They got their voices heard. And that is the way speech should occur on campus. When you have literally mobs on campus trying to silence speech of a speaker, incidentally, Charles Murray, who I would venture to say perhaps 1% of the students who sort of tried to shut down that speech had actually read what he wrote. That's when you
a lot of them admitted they had not.
Yeah.
And were choosing not to because what they were told they would find if they actually read it.
And this is what passes, unfortunately, for discourse these days, at least in some situations. Again, the Charles Murray situation was so unfortunate because I fear that those who aren't on university campuses day in and day out will take from that the impression that all college students are like this or all faculty are like this, and it's simply not the case.
Well, here's what I want to do, only because we could go all day with this, and I will just tell you, if you want to have a continuation of this discussion, go to the Ingle Auditorium tonight, 7 p.m. Alan Charles Kors is going to be giving a lecture, No Freedom of Speech, No Higher Education. It is free and open to the public. We're down to our last couple of minutes, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask our panelists, what do we do next? If we're identifying problems, as you see, what do you want to do next? About 30 seconds each. I'm going to start with you. What do you want to see change? What should happen?
Universities should proclaim as their foremost value freedom of inquiry. That's what they're there for, freedom of discussion, debate. Universities should be centers not of indoctrination, not of one point of view. Universities do debates best, reasoned debates, and they should stress that freedom lies at their heart, at the heart of their mission, and that everyone should be brought into the circle of equal protection of the laws and full freedom of expression and protest.
As Professor Primo, by the way, did last night at the University of Rochester, as we said, which won't get headlines. What would you add? About 20 seconds, what would you add?
So I would ask administrators to, when they're thinking about diversity on campus, which is something that they think a lot about, there's a chief diversity officer at the University of Rochester that reports directly to the president, that they broaden their concept of diversity beyond the traditional checkboxes of race and gender and ethnicity, and think about the diversity of viewpoints on campuses, because campuses are extremely non-diverse when it comes to alternative perspectives being represented on campus.
All right, Dean Feldman.
I'd agree with the points just made. I think one other thing that I'd add, and this goes back to Alan's point earlier on, do everything we can to encourage people to interact with people not like themselves. We do that on our campus and our intercultural center, but make that work.
Joseph Fornieri.
I'd like to see campuses follow the example of the University of Chicago and have a free speech manifesto. I'd also think we can have our cake and eat it too in terms of protecting student safety, but also preserving speech. And that would involve using our resources, our vast resources in some cases, to pay for First Amendment lawyers who could make the important distinction in these codes between speech and action.
RIT deserves credit for putting this symposium together, Joseph. Thank you, and thanks for
I think there's a diverse atmosphere there, and I'm proud to be part of it.
All right, very good. The symposium continues this weekend again, 7 p.m. tonight in the Engel Auditorium if you want to meet Alan Charles Kors and hear his lecture. Thank you, Alan, for being here.
Good. Professor and debate Primo. With me.
There you go. And debate. Dean Feldman, thank you. Joe, thank you.
Thank
more
you.
Connections coming up.
Thank you.